everybody. Welcome to a very special telephone. We literally phoned this one in. Episode of the Theme Stealers podcast. This is Trevin McGee, and I'm here with Eric Moline and Trey Hawk, my two partners in crime. We got a few movies to talk about this week. First off, we're going to talk about a small movie called The Dark Knight Rises. We've all seen it. Last week we talked about it a little bit on Bad Sick Plan. We can get into spoilers and really tear it apart now, so we're going to do that. We're also going to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is a movie that Trey got to see. And Eric, did you see that one as well?
Damn, Skippy. I should mention that our Dark Knight Rises review will not be spoiler-free. From the very top, we're going to discuss in detail its themes and a lot of other issues playing around it. And we should tell people, if you have not seen The Dark Knight Rises already, do not listen any further to this podcast.
Very, very good advice. If you want to read non-spoiler, non-specific reviews, you can definitely go to the Theme Stealers website and look at our print review. Eric and I both put print reviews in that stay pretty cautious when it came to plot points. But no, this is going to be spoiler heavy. So I think that's going to be the larger part of the conversation. So, you know, as much as we've talked about, maybe it's a good time to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild first and go ahead and get that set up and out of the way. Because that is the
movie
that's
opening this week.
Sure.
I'll let Trey set this one up, and we'll make it kind of short, and then we'll get into the meat of the Dark Knight.
Yeah, absolutely, because there's plenty of content on the site if you want to read lots and lots about Beasts of the Southern Wild. But it's a film that takes place in Louisiana. Its central characters are Hush Puppy, a young 6-year-old girl, and her father, Wink, who she lives with in a rural community, I mean, kind of a wilderness community almost, outside of the trappings of modern life. They raise their own food, they catch their own food, and they live almost entirely out of modern urban civilization. Hush Puppy and Wink have a pretty troubled, estranged, almost adult-to-adult relationship. But you can, even though there is a lot of turbulence and a lot of difficulty in this, you can also tell that the father is in many ways trying to prepare Hush Puppy to kind of live in what is a pretty unforgiving world. Anything you want to add? I mean, I think that's I'm trying to just keep it really brief, but I mean, we need to mention the aurochs at some point and some other stuff, but
without getting, I guess you could say that this movie lives in a sort of magical realism. Really what's unique about this film is the fact that the filmmakers, Ben Zeitlin and his collective, with funding from the Sundance Institute mentioned, are trying to give us a perspective through this, the eyes of the 6-year-old. And I think that's really what makes this movie unique, because it has sort of a where the wild things are. It's the way the story is told that makes it interesting. If it was a documentary style, I don't think it would be nearly as compelling. All sorts of raw, and we've seen all sorts of gritty, and we've seen poor people, you know, and the portrayals like that before in films. But something about this, the way that the shots, the way that the light falls on them, the way that there are parts of the story that aren't so much explained as they're just featured, and then you just kind of allow it to sink in to put this bigger, are really unique, and I really want to see this movie again. I remember when I was first watching it, I was thinking, I'm never going to want to see this movie again, because it's just so tough to watch this this poor girl go through all this bad advice and all this stuff with the people in her community. But then, like, ever since then, it's been a week and a half now since I've seen it, I've been thinking more about it, and the things that I can't get out of my head are the images.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And you're kind of, I think you're hinting at what I feel about it also, and that is that this is a story that is not told through detailed plotting. It is told by jumping from emotional moment to emotional moment. And there is, it's all about the emotional arc. It's almost, I don't want to say it's not important what happens, the what that happens, but it's, you know, it is definitely less important the details of what specifically happens. And that takes a back seat to how we feel through this entire film. And that is driven by the visuals that, you know, in part come from the mind of this child and in part have to do with the community and the geography that surround her. So I concur. You know, it is, I have said since walking out of it that I think it's one of my, it's definitely one of my favorites from 2012 so far. But I just think it's, it is definitely, it's unique, it's sincere in a way that is feels really good, instead of being overly sincere and, you know, kind of pat and cliche. It's, you know, I found it a very fulfilling watch.
Yeah, I haven't really ranked all the movies that I've seen this year or even once to try to figure out what I like, but if I'm not mistaken, this is the first movie that I've given a rock fist way up to, which means it's my favorite movie of the year.
Awesome.
So visually, it's able to overcome some of the storytelling elements, like the visuals are that compelling, or is that
it's not a visual story? No, it's not that it overcomes storytelling aspects. It's that, you know, in a similar way to like, you know, even like a Terrence Malick film, where the details of the plotting aren't as critical as the emotions that we feel and the emotions that the emotional arc that we go through. That's what's important. It's not that this is sloppy. It's not. What happens is actually relatively simple. I mean, we and you could go, oh well, she then goes here, and then this happens, and then her father gets sick, and then this happens. You know, you could go through and draw pretty clear lines of why the plot goes where it goes. That is just less important than where we go emotionally and the emotional arc that not only the characters go through, but that we as viewers go through also.
I see.
Yeah. And that's all driven by the video.
So what – I know that you interviewed some people on the site, some people that worked on the film, and that you knew some of the people, those guys – from projects that you've worked on in the past. I guess my major question is, aside from the main thing is, boy, I don't even know how to describe it. If there are decisions being made by characters, is everything being filtered through her? Or is there a scene that we're not experiencing the world through her in the entire film?
You know, I don't think we get a scene without her, and hers is the only voiceover narration that we get. I think this is her film through her eyes, start to finish.
Yeah, and I guess going through it a second time and watching it again, I'll be able to figure that out a little better, because
sure.
Paying attention, you know, the first time to everything is very difficult in a movie to stunt.
You know, one thing that I really want to look at, and just as an aside, I did know a number of the crew members. I knew four of them. I knew set decorator, set dresser, I knew the gaffer, and I knew the best boy, Key Grip. And I do want to mention that though they thoroughly enjoyed their time working with Court 13 and the people who made this film, that none of them were directly responsible for any of the sort of creative choices necessarily. And I mean that really loosely, because a gaffer makes decisions on how to wrap and mold light, and that is a creative decision. But they weren't responsible for writing the story, directing the actors. They weren't responsible for producing the film or anything like that. So I do want to say that. But one of the things that I think I want to really look for is I want to look at your camera. I want to look at the camera angles on the second viewing, and if we're always getting camera angles that are when we're looking at Nazi, who plays Hush Puppy, when we're looking at Hush Puppy, are we always looking at her eye level? And when we're looking at other characters, are we always looking up from Hush Puppy's perspective? And that'll be a really interesting thing to see if they are using that to accentuate the fact that it is from her perspective. But that's something that I don't recall. I mean, I can recall specific shots and specific moments where they did employ that, but I can't remember if it was consistent throughout or if it was just a handful of times where they wanted to accentuate the moment.
Right.
So either way, we can agree this is a pretty incredible movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
So overall, does it have kind of a Pan's Labyrinth sort of fairy tale feel to it, or?
No, it's not. I mean,
how would you describe it?
Sort of. But here's the thing. I'm hesitant to go there because it's never encapsulated that way. Like in Where the Wild Things Are, there is the precedent that was set from the children's book. In Pan's Labyrinth, we have the mythology that is embedded. Now, in Beasts of the Southern Wild, we have a very brief reference to the aurochs, these kind of mythic beasts that were mm-hmm. just wild things. They're just wild, like wild beasts mm-hmm. that used to roam the earth, and they were loyal and violent, and they travel in packs. And they're just live an unforgiving life. It's not enough. It's not developed enough to be a fully structured mythology that we're kind of looking through. It is simply a visual metaphor. It becomes a visual metaphor for the way Hush Puppy engages her world and understands and orders her world. And so it's not quite structured enough for us to go, oh, well, it's just it's like a children's book. It really is something that is a means for her to engage the world around her. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
I mean, kind of. You could, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, I made reference to Where the Wild Things Are. I made reference to Kill a Mockingbird. It wouldn't surprise me at all if somebody comes out of this and thinks of it in a sort of Pan's Labyrinth way, but it's not quite as steeped and immersive within the sort of mythology of the children's book or the children's mythology or fairy tale as a Pan's Labyrinth is.
I see. So do you guys think it'll be remembered around award season?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, without a doubt. There are at least, well, there are two incredible performances, and it's the type of film, I would be shocked if it won. I would be, I would be pleasantly surprised. Now, that's also prefacing this comment that there's 6 months of movies that I have not, or, 5 months of movies that I still have yet to see. So this
right.
could go lower on the list, but... It is a unique and sort of it is a unique vision that brought this film to life. So it's the type of film that I think is at least for critics and movie lovers, people who see movies consistently, it's a movie that's easy for them to get behind. Because you can see such clear vision in the direction and in the craft of the story.
All right. Well, I guess all it's left is for you guys to give me your ratings.
Oh, yeah. Rock Fist way up.
Malene?
Rock Fist way up.
All right. Well, that's That's the most positively reviewed movie on the site for this year so far.
So are we going to talk about this Dark Knight thing?
I think it's time, yeah. That's Beast of the Southern Wild right now. I mean, it's limited release. I don't think it's showing in Lawrence at this point. Eric, do you know for sure?
I think it comes out, it's like August 8th, I want to say. Something like
yeah.
that.
Yep.
It'll yeah.
be there in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so yeah, so, yeah the Lawrence kids will get a taste.
Yeah, Lawrence will get yours in a couple of weeks. But it is definitely out in Kansas City today.
Yep, so. Absolutely.
All right, well now, this other movie... to talk about Dark Knight Rises, you know, it's the final movie that Christopher Nolan's doing in the Batman trilogy, the Dark Knight trilogy, as it's now being called, apparently. And it's gotten some interesting people who've had some time to write about it, have some time to think about it. I've read some interesting takes on what happened in the film. We already reviewed it. Eric and I, we both gave it the same rating, but with a few, you know, I had a few issues and he had a few different issues, but we both gave it solid rock fist up. I had some problems with it that I didn't have with the previous two. Trey did manage to go see it, which I thought wouldn't happen for at least a couple of weeks.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was, here's the thing, is that regardless of my take, I thought this was an important film to see. Mm-hmm. It is the final final installment in the quote-unquote Dark Knight trilogy. But also, you know, I have probably in some ways against my will kind of become... a counterpoint to the rave reviews of the summer movies, and I think it's important because there are people out there that go to these big blockbuster summer movies and walk out of it and don't understand what everyone else is seeing in the film, and they need somebody that they can that knows is there holding them as they cry into their pillow at night.
Yeah, you're the champion of the enlightened.
Well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not making any qualifications. All I'm saying is that for those people who are confused by the unequivocally rave reviews of some of these films, I am in the same boat with them. So I'm not saying enlightened. I'm not saying that I am better. I'm not saying making any sort of those types of qualifications.
Okay, well, I want to talk about this film without doing a plot summary because it's going to take, and there's no point in getting into it because everybody knows what it's about. So
exactly.
I'd like to introduce this review by giving you a quote from the movie, one that I know is going to start us off in the right / wrong direction, depending on... answers first. So here's the quote. There's a storm coming. You and your friends better batten down the hatches, because when it hits, you're all going to wonder how you ever thought you could live so large and leave so little for the rest of us.
All right. So you gave us the quote. Now what do you want us to do with it?
I want one of you to react to it first. And that's how...
Okay, I'll react to it. Because I think this, to some extent, gets to... You know, and I don't want to belabor this, because in reading both of your reviews, I felt like in both of them that the rating you gave to the film was slightly elevated based on the review that you the written review. And I don't want to belabor that at all, because that could be more the limitation of the rating system than anything else. So I don't want to belabor that. But this quote, I think, it can start us off talking about the fact that Nolan is trying to embed in this a, you know, sort of, I guess, socio-political discussion on a number of different issues. One is sort of the 99%ers versus the 1%, the Occupy Wall Street movement, the cash grab on Wall Street, you know, the sort of sentiment of the dissonance between Wall Street and Main Street, all of that. as well as sentiments towards terrorism and whatever. And I think with that one, and with most of the like the socio-political stuff that he embedded in there, he embedded so much that he only had time to touch on each thing and then had to let it go. So none of it, instead of focusing on one and making that the sort of core, the heart of the film, and then really going for it, he touches on a whole lot of things and never really wraps it up fully in any satisfying way. And that was a problem. Now, here's the thing. This is a costume superhero movie. So do I expect a detailed critical analysis of the dissonance between, you know, the 1%ers and the 99%ers? No. It's a costume superhero movie. I'm just saying that he could have made the choice to choose one thing and go for it and really, really address it in a way that felt at least a little more satisfying. Because that's one thing. I felt like after that statement was made, we got a little more of that. We saw how it played out, and then that was the end of it. That was the end of it. You know, it wasn't, there was no resolution, there was no addressing it, there was no weighing the pros and cons to that statement, because there is some truth to that statement. There is also a backlash to that statement, and depending on where you stand, you can make that, you can take that statement to heart, and you can make it a positive, you can take that statement to heart, and you can make it an aggressive and angry and violent negative. And those types of things weren't addressed. The sort of philosophical underpinnings of what that statement means were not fully addressed. And that's the way it was across the board with all of that stuff.
I would say that I was totally fine with the fact that there were all sorts of real allusions in this film and things being brought up, because the way that I feel about many of these issues is that they are full of contradictions, and there's no easy way out. And it's best embodied by the one person in the film who, up to this point, we have really felt like he is unimpeachable when it comes to the moral ground that he stands on, and that's Commissioner Gordon. And when Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character rails on him for being a hypocrite, we finally feel, and we sat there guilty as charged. I think those are the kind of contradictions that this movie is bringing up. And I don't think that there is an easy solution, and I don't even think that that they should have focused on just one issue, because to focus on one issue and then have the film resolved, like most superhero movies have to be resolved, would be to simplify it and reduce it. And I think that having those issues in the film actually enriches it and told more complicated story, because nobody in this film stands on high moral ground. Everybody is sullied. Everybody has stuck their hands into the mud, as Gordon says in his scene.
Well, and here I do want to clarify, because I'm not suggesting that any of these issues gets oversimplified and solved. I just think that you can discuss for days, let alone a couple of hours, the dissonance and the philosophical approaches to the distance between the extremely wealthy and everyone else. And I think that that is in and of itself a complex and multifaceted problem that any number of people can come at with any number of different philosophies, any number of partial solutions or things that they think are solutions. And that's what I'm saying, is that we don't even really delve into the true complexity of any of these things. What does it mean to be a terrorist? How complex are our villains? Who are our heroes, and are they really our heroes? I mean, that's the thing, is that he really...
All these things are brought up.
All of those things are brought up, and I think in some ways, all of those things are brought up, it does a somewhat a disservice to each one of them. Now, again, I want to reiterate that I didn't walk out of the movie thinking that I was going to be really philosophically engaged, and I wasn't. All that happened were those aspects were brought up, then never really dealt with, and then the movie ended. And I think that he could have dealt with one of them more fully in a way that did not fully solve the problem, because I'm not suggesting that, but that at least explored the issue in a more satisfying way. That's all I'm saying.
I have more problems with the film on a structural level than anything else in terms of pacing and things like that. Things that I'm criticizing, and I did in my review criticize
sure.
the film for,
sure.
are things that any movie would suffer from. But when it comes to dealing with themes, what I'm trying to say is that the exemplary parts of the movie are the parts that Trey has a problem with. I think criticize the movie on are the fact that Batman, a giant spaceship, and the fact that some of the more traditional superhero elements of the plot are resolved in very traditional ways. I think that he works so hard trying to get the contradictions of the modern world in there that I think that he had to resort, Nolan and his brother Jonathan Nolan, to some pretty traditional plot elements. And that's a little bit too bad.
I would agree with you completely. I mean, this is, on that note especially, I think that its biggest problems to me come from a script, from a writing standpoint. It does cut some corners in some specific places. That opening line that you read, like, my reaction to that is that it's just kind of convenient writing. Because that really is the only time the whole class struggle is really directly touched on. She's just kind of there, and then you get a couple other references, and then the movie kind of, it's all just set up to kind of give somebody else, to give Bane an army towards the end of the movie. So, there were definitely some issues in the story's logic that I had and some corners that it cut that the previous movies just didn't really do. I've seen it twice. I did like it more the second time. It answered so much.
Yeah, I had the opposite.
Really? I had major, like, plotting issues and stuff the first time, and then after second time, some of my problems were kind of resolved or answered or wiped away, like it was kind of dealt with on a second viewing. But my biggest hang-ups, you know, I agree, it's way too much like a normal superhero movie in some parts, especially considering it's a series that totally elevated and kind of redefined what you could do with a superhero series. I mean, like, those movies were about something. They had larger themes. You can debate whether or not those were you know, like, delivered upon, but the fact that it had them at all, or that it had that level of ambition, is, you know, significantly, you know, heads and shoulders above what other superhero movies were and are continuing to do.
I mean, here's the thing. I do agree with you. I definitely preferred this to the Avengers, which I was bored in most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But with, you know, there are just a number of things that I guess people are praising that I in some ways I'm a little confused. I mean, it's not just plotting, because I mean, I think there are things, and I'm just going to get them out there, like, you know, this sort of the healing a broken back by punching his vertebrae. I mean, that's a pretty that's a pretty traditional comic book solve. And there's part of me that's okay with it, but there's part of me that's just like, hey, you hadn't done that up until this point, and now you're going to do that. Another thing that felt very, at the same time it felt very comic booky, it felt like a cheat within the realm of these movies, was when Ra's al Ghul gives critical explication in one of Bruce Wayne's fever dreams. I thought that was a total cheat. I'm just jamming through these plot points really quick because I don't want to labor on the plot points.
And it is a total cheat, and it's one that once it's established, like, the entire narrative moves forward with that assumed information as being correct.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Even though the child ends up being someone other than who he thinks he is, the whole notion that there is one and that Ra's al Ghul had one, like, that is introduced through a hallucination and that only he knows about.
Right.
And somehow it becomes canon for the rest of the plot moving, and it's delivered upon, you know.
Right, right. I thought that was totally, yeah, it's unreasonable. And it did feel like a cheat. Things like, you know, things about the reactor that felt like a total MacGuffin trapped inside of a mousetrap board. You know, just stuff like that. And these aren't things that, if any one of them had come up in the film, it wouldn't have broken the film. And I don't know that the film is totally broken regardless.
Right.
But it's just, they felt less than satisfying, I guess, is all I'm saying. You know, Michael Caine didn't have enough screen time, so that then the two main times when he really had some screen time, I thought that he had to almost overdo it in an attempt to really get that emotion in there. And whereas Eric, I think in your review, you mentioned that Michael Caine was one of the most emotional, like, and best parts of it. To me, he felt, you know, syrupy. You know, it really felt like he was overdoing it. And I think in part of that was because he didn't have enough screen time. He didn't have enough time to develop that emotional appeal that he should have had. All you would have had to do
So I guess what I have to say to defend that only is that if you have recently watched Batman Begins,
which I have.
you will have to put that performance and the plot that we learned in that movie to get that. And I agree that's a feeling of the film, in that, you know, you shouldn't have to rely on another movie to get something across. But at the same time, I think he did some amazing work that is really at the heart of it, a very old-fashioned kind of a thing. We don't go around talking about, you know, butlers who revere their masters as much as he does. And it's kind of a quaint... I thought he did an amazing job of making it a human thing and making it come to life.
I think that he could have. I think if you gave him one more scene, it would have totally worked for me. I thought that he was asked, I thought Michael Caine was asked too much of to put all of the emotion into those two scenes. And I have recently seen Batman Begins. In fact, I watched it in anticipation of going to Dark Knight Rises, and even with that, it still doesn't quite work for me, you know, but that's a minor point. I would say that's a relatively minor point. So
let's talk about something really interesting. I just want to change a little bit. To me, when I watched this film the first time, I remember being the only person in the theater to laugh out loud a couple different times at things that may not have been things I was supposed to be laughing out loud at. Same response when I watched the movie Precious for the second time, and I started to take it in on a different level as being a kind of cult camp classic. And this movie, watching it again the second time, the same reaction. I think that the more times we watch this film and we approach it as an alternative, with an alternative viewpoint of not necessarily the narrative that Nolan wants us to be approaching it with, there is a lot of entertaining stuff in here, starting with Bane's accent and going forward to some of the choices that that even Gary Oldman makes. I mean, and the fact that they're sending people out on the ice and the whole way that the Scarecrow you know, deals with people. Everything, there are certain things in there where they're trying to blend this dark humor in there, and I don't know. Like, I think the more that we see this, the less serious it will become, the more that it could be considered to be, you know, campy. So I'm just going to bring that up.
Yeah, I know. And Trevin, I'll let you jump in, but I want to jump in on this too.
Go ahead.
Oh, good. You know, Eric, I think that gets at the heart of what has been my biggest problem with all of these films, is that people do take them so seriously and hold them up as these, like, you know, works of art. And when you get right down to it, oftentimes, even something as simple as screen direction within his films are just sloppy. There's little attention to detail. The plots are so crystalline, they just shatter. And I think if more people had your attitude, that these are campy fun, and it's meant to be taken and consumed on that level, I don't think I would have half the problem I do with these films. Because you saying that...
I don't think it's meant to. I'm saying that I can take it that way.
Right.
And that maybe there's more humor in it than people are thinking.
I think that Nolan takes it deadly seriously. And I think his true fan base takes it deadly seriously. And I think if people would stop taking this film as high art, I would be fine with these films. I would be fine with these films. You know, because that's the thing, is I just don't think they deserve, they're okay. They aren't great. And they do not deserve the praise that they garner. And that's the thing, is it's like listening to somebody rave about Nickelback. I mean, that's an unfair correlation.
Yeah, well,
to draw.
First of all, that's a totally bogus hypothetical, because no one raves about Nickelback.
Right, that's true. That is true. But you know what I'm saying. It's like hearing somebody rave about something that you're like, is that really worth that amount of praise? And that's all I'm saying, is that I don't think I would have quite the problem, but so many people treat these as if they are film perfection.
Your reaction to these movies is kind of like my reaction when someone who thinks they know my sense of humor that just assumes that I love Family Guy and I fucking hate it. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is it?
But I'll say, to defend that trade, the thing about it is I'd rather have people hold this up as a precedent than some movie like Watchmen.
Sure. I mean, I can always...
Yeah,
can come up with any number of films that I would prefer, that I would
but
prefer
I'm saying,
or
but I'm
hate
saying
them
if you
to.
Yeah, no, but I agree, but I'm saying that's easy to do, but if you're looking for, like, another superhero... Like, I'm trying to make it as apples to apples as possible.
Another superhero franchise...
takes itself incredibly seriously. It has a pretty rabid fan base around the people who did like it. You know, I think that Watchmen is a trash movie.
Oh, I agree.
I think that the Dark Knight trilogy, actually, even when it falls short, it at least has an ambition to it, a scope, a goal. And whether Nolan's sloppy or not, he's attempting and at times succeeding to do things that most directors don't even bother with.
I want to jump in on this, too, because here's something that you guys are, all three of us are really going to be looking forward to. With the Nolan movies, I think that Trevin and I at least will agree that he does better than most other people, and that to a certain extent he's elevated blockbusters to be able to throw in interesting ideas and deliver at least interesting questions. Whereas somebody like Zack Snyder on Watchmen ignores interesting ideas and goes for pure fetishism, and also completely misunderstands the point. Now, hyperviolence and whatnot, but taking all that into consideration, how much are you not looking for Man of Steel, directed by Zack Snyder, and produced
and
by
written.
Written
and produced.
That's
a shitstorm for you, Trey. That's like a worst-case scenario for you.
No, it actually isn't. Here's the thing. That movie is a total non-issue in my world. It is a non-entity. But I want to point out is that just like Steven Spielberg choosing to work with Michael Bay, I think hints at the passions and what is behind the eyes of Steven Spielberg. I think Christopher Nolan's willingness and excitement or you know, whatever, partnering with Zack Snyder hints at what is actually going on in this man's brain. And so
here's the thing. The ultimate thing that Trey wants to say at the end of this podcast is he wants to throw pee out with the bathwater. And because Jonathan Nolan is now hooked up with Zack Snyder, that's proof that Jonathan Nolan is
Christopher Nolan. No, I mean, here's the thing. Christopher Nolan has not made a single film that is not without significant flaw. I mean, he just has he's made okay films.
You kind of cut out here, but Memento was on my top 10 list of the best movies of the last decade. That movie, with the exception of the fact that its premise is completely ridiculous, is entirely almost without flaw.
Yeah, but you have to accept the fact that its premise is completely impossible. Not only ridiculous, but completely impossible.
Which is pretty much how most of his movies are. And the fact that he can sucker people in and make them feel something.
That's not a flaw.
Yeah, that's not a flaw, Trey. That's the thing that Prometheus is inherently flawed before the titles roll, because we've never visited another planet, or we don't have robots. We don't have humanoid robots.
No, I'm just saying.
It's a reach in logic. It's a stretch.
It's not a stretch.
To tell a story.
Within the context of the world of the film, his films are flawed. The plots are flawed.
I disagree.
If the man doesn't have short-term memory within the context of the film, then he won't remember his own disease. That's within the context of the film. Prometheus, within the context of that world, they can make it to other planets.
Prometheus fails on different levels. He can't make new memories. That's why he has all the tattoos that remind him that he can't make new memories.
By the time he finds out about his disease, he can't make new memories.
He already knew about the disease.
Okay.
He knew what it was. There's a whole scene where he knows how it works.
Okay. Anyway, that's Memento.
I could go on about the Prestige, too. That movie's amazing.
Yeah.
About the Prestige?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's fine. I do think Nolan is an overrated director, through and through. And that's fine. I totally understand that I am in a pretty well developed minority, but I'm in the minority on that. Is there anything else that we need to address? I've got a couple more points, but they're minor and we've kind of talked around them. As far as Dark Knight's concerned?
You never gave a Rockfish rating on Dark Knight because you didn't have to write a print review, Trey. What would you give it?
I'm utterly anti-Swiss Fist unless you end up in a film that you weren't equipped to review.
Right.
So I'm pretty anti-Swiss Fist. I wish there was I walked out of it not upset, but not excited. So if there was a split fist between, there was some stuff that I liked about it, and I would like to actually get to that. There was some stuff I did like about it, but there was a ton of stuff that just made the movie fail in my eyes. It probably would be a minor rock fist down, but I'm kind of split between a minor rock fist up and a minor rock fist down. I didn't have to pay to see the movie. That always is the little bit of sugar that helps take my medicine. So I didn't have to pay for the film. But, I didn't walk out of the film mad. And that, to me, always speaks to a minor rock fist up, even if it's a fundamentally flawed. And in reading your guys' review, I was surprised when I went back and looked at what rating you had given it. Your reviews seemed like minor rock fists up. Yours seemed like very positive minor rock fists up, but minor rock fists up. I would have given it a negative minor rock fist up if I were going to give it anything.
If you've seen it and you want to talk about it, go ahead and put it in the comments for us. We've been chatting up all week on Facebook, Twitter, just about everywhere else we can talk about it. You can also check out the Dad's Big Plan podcast from last week where we discussed it as well. And, I think we should go ahead and put the list of Batman for a while because we're at pretty much full saturation at this point.
Goodbye, Batman.
Well, it'll be back as Zack Snyder will reboot it or somebody will reboot it, and then you'll miss the Nolan days. then you'll look
fondly
on...
I'll never knew I had it so good.
Yeah, you'll look fondly on the day where Christopher Nolan had the franchise instead of McGee or whoever they picked to run it next.
Whoever.
But, right. But I think we should go, everybody. Have a good Friday. Beast of the Southern Wild, go see it. If you live in Lawrence, come to Kansas City and see it, or just wait it out for 2 weeks and then see it at Liberty Hall. Dark Knight Rises, I don't have to tell anyone to go see because you already did. But yeah, tell us what you think, and we'll be back next week with some more movies.
Adios.